Hello and welcome to Intelligence Squared, where great minds meet. I'm head of programming, Connor Boyle. We're in the presence of comedy and satire greatness for this episode, as we're joined by Armando Iannucci, the razor-sharp wit behind the writing for shows and movies such as The Thick of It, Veep, Alan Partridge, and The Death of Stalin, and he's currently working on a stage production of Stanley Kubrick's Dr. Strangelove, starring none other than Steve Coogan. Armando was live on stage recently discussing the power of comedy in the dark political times we live in for our Intelligence Squared event at London's Union Chapel. It was a great evening with tons to dig into, so we're bringing you this one in three parts. If you're an Intelligence Squared member, you can get parts 2 and 3 right now with no waiting around. And part 3 is our exclusive members-only extended audience Q&A. You'll also get all of our special mini-series and ad-free listening too. Just head to intelligencesquared.com/membership to sign up, or hit subscribe on Apple for just the audio. It's now time to join our host for the evening, Helen Lewis. She's staff writer at The Atlantic and former deputy editor of The New Statesman. Here's Helen with more.
Thank you. Hello.
Iannucci has an almost embarrassingly full CV of many things you will have heard and watched over your lifetime, including The Thick of It, Veep, In The Loop, Time Trumpet, a personal favourite.
Thank you.
And tonight we're going to be talking about comedy in dark times. You also recently wrote a book of COVID verses, put on a COVID panto, but that's lowballing it a bit, isn't it? It was a physical play.
Yes. It started off it was called Pandemonium. It started off as a poem about COVID and the Johnson era's approach to COVID. And then I did a stage version, because the poem itself I wrote before we even knew about parties that were going on at Number 10. And I actually thought that, you know, the parties news is quite significant, I think. That puts a whole new complexion on how we interpret how well they've done. So I updated it. And then by the time it came on, we'd had the whole Liz Truss thing.
At some point, you just have to go, I'm going to have a cut-off period for things going wrong. I just have to impose an artificial limit on that. Enough things have gone wrong, yeah. No more.
It's so funny when you say Liz Truss, you don't go like that. It's just, you do. You sort of forget, and then you remember. And it just, whoa, it was like that. It's okay.
I went on holiday for 2 weeks, very rare occasion for me, so I missed literally half of Liz Truss's premiership.
And I do think, because the Queen died not...
The day after meeting Liz Truss.
The day after meeting.
Let's be honest.
She kind of said, "You know, I've seen so many prime ministers. I'm not hanging around for this one."
You're on your own.
But it does mean, you know, in years to come, when they dig out the kind of the response to the Queen's death and so on, there'll be this strange person near at all the events, looking a bit weird and kind of like that, you know. And people go, "Who is that?" And it'd be Liz Truss.
Someone did a brilliant graphic of all the prime ministers lined up, all the living ones, at the cenotaph, and he made them in width order by how long they've been prime minister. So it was quite a wide Tony Blair, a very skinny Gordon Brown, then he had a wide Cameron again, yeah. And then it got like Russian dolls until there was a kind of almost subliminal sliver of Liz Truss. Just at the end, that's it.
Yeah.
She lived her life like a candle in the wind.
Oh, right. A scented candle that stinks of death. But she wants to make a comeback because she thinks now that she was right and everyone was wrong. And therefore she's the sane one and we're all the mad ones. Mm. And she's launched a new group called... Because she is the most unpopular prime minister there's ever been in what is currently the most unpopular party there's ever been. So she's called her new group Popular Conservatives.
I feel like even the other MPs are a bit... Thank you, Liz, you've delighted us long enough, because she wanted to bring in a very American kind of culture war gender bill in, yeah. And Labour talked it out by talking about, I think, licences for ferrets. So I think even within the House of Commons, there is a level of sort of, don't call us, Liz. Anyway, we'll get back to modern politics, but I want to go back slightly in time. Not that far back in time. I remember talking to you, I think immediately post-Brexit, maybe in the stuck period where it just seemed like people just went through division lobbies a lot and nothing happened. Mm-hmm. And you at the time were doing David Copperfield and Avenue Q.
Yep.
So you went backwards in time and forwards in time.
Yes.
And I think maybe that was a result of you thinking that everything was so bleak in the present that you just
yes.
wanted to opt out of satire That's, or comedy about the
yes.
present.
Yes, I mean,
time.
We'd had Brexit and then we had Donald Trump in succession, and it possibly is no coincidence that I did The Death of Stalin set in the 1950s, and then David Copperfield set in the 1840s, and then Avenue 5 set in 30 years' time. And it, perhaps subliminally, it was a way of, you know, what's happening at the moment is going to take a while to process, really. And you could, I suppose, do very immediate responses to what was going on. And I think that was like the golden era of Twitter being very funny and so on, because people could just turn around stuff really quickly. Whereas, you know, if I wanted to do something more long form, like a series, I just felt it's so febrile at the moment that by the time I make something, it will all have changed anyway. So, you know, that I think I had that urge to just step back a bit and see, just take how we were behaving then as a soft starting point for any project.
And when you step back,
yeah.
what did you end up thinking about that period? Because I remember it was essentially the period that ended my career in political journalism. I was deputy editor of the New Statesman at the time, and I just remember watching this series of Brexit votes,
yeah.
and everybody agreed that they didn't like Theresa May's deal, but they couldn't really tell you what they did like,
yes.
apart from 30 people who had wanted this since they were in basically short trousers at Eton and had a very clear idea about what they wanted. And it just felt like British politics was stuck.
Yeah.
And I think when I talk to people now about Brexit, whichever way they voted, one of the things they think is that went on for quite a long time, didn't it?
Yeah.
There's a kind of opportunity cost about it that was very high. But what are your main kind of
Well, I remember when the Brexit result came in, the first thing I tweeted was, oh God, there's going to be a lot of politics now, isn't there? And I sort of still feel that. I mean, it still hasn't died down, really. I mean, at the moment, we are not allowed, neither of the main parties are really allowed to talk about Brexit and its consequences. It's almost like it's too embarrassing to talk about or too awkward. And I remember at the time, I think for a lot of people, it was about, you know, why have I got this so wrong? You know, I just, like a lot of people, I think, you know, I thought, well, there's no way we're going to vote for Brexit. That'd be mad, wouldn't it? Because, and so I think there was a lot of, not just shock at what happened, but actually self-questioning. You know, have I been looking at the world aright? Have I been have I not? Why didn't I spot this? Really, and I think for a lot of politicians as well, there's been that for the Labour Party particularly, where they stand on it and what their position on it was. It was very. I think it was confusing. For a long time, really.
I think when I look back on that, you're right. And not just Remain politicians who were kind
yeah.
of, oh, why does everyone hate us? Although you would say that, you know, George Osborne did not do a budget beforehand, and there's a kind of giveaway budget, a feel-good budget yeah, that kind yeah. of everyone would go into thinking it. But then the great images of Michael Gove and Boris Johnson looking like someone Absolutely. Killed their puppy the yeah. day after. Oh!
There's that great film, The Candidate, Robert Redford, who plays as someone who runs for a Senate seat. And the point is, he's told, you'll be the perfect candidate. The point is, you will lose, so don't worry about it. But and you see him being molded from this kind of very real, very liberal but honest person into a kind of being molded into the perfect senatorial candidate, politician, Democrat politician, so on. And him gradually compromise what he will say and not say. And then he wins. And then there's just the final scene is everyone, as the results are announced, they're watching it in a hotel kind of bedroom suite and the results went. And then all the press and all the volunteers are all crowding into the room. And he's just stuck on the end of one bed looking across to his campaign manager who's stuck at the other end. And he just goes, what do we do now? What do we do now? And then it ends, that's it. And that, I felt, was what Boris Johnson and Michael Gove were kind of feeling the morning after the referendum thing. Because they genuinely did not, specifically Boris Johnson, did not expect to win.
That does make me think of, have you ever watched the film Bulworth with Warren Beatty, in which he's a senator who's so depressed he takes a hit out on himself, and this liberates him to just say
whatever.
Why don't we decriminalise drugs? Why are we locking all these people up?
Yeah.
And I just sort of think maybe Boris Johnson should have taken a hit out on himself and said, if I don't get Brexit done within, you know...
I think he would have taken a hit out on Michael Gove if he knew what was coming.
Yeah, that's probably true. I mean, yes, that may be my favourite moment in the sad betrayal of Boris Johnson by Michael Gove. You hate to see it. You recently wrote in the New Statesman, I think this is a really great phrase, real politique has been replaced by feel politique. Can you explain?
Okay. Well, I refer you to my piece in the New Statesman. It's that thing of, and we mentioned Liz Truss
earlier,
who... You know, she was a prime example of in that, you know, when she was foreign secretary, she would go to, with her entourage, she would go to Australia to discuss a deal. But she spent most of her time trying to line up a shot under the Sydney harbour with a bicycle
and a
Union Jack. That's what she spent the bulk of her time trying to organise for her Instagram account. And it's that, it's like politicians like her, like Boris and so on. They spend the bulk of their time not so much dealing with stuff, but looking like they're dealing with stuff. You know, coming up with the image of someone who deals with stuff rather than actually dealing with stuff. Because the dealing with stuff is a bit boring and tedious and involves a bit of application and forethought. Whereas, what's also happened is they've now become a tradition of us voting for candidates not for their ability, not even for their plan, but because they say the same things as us. You know, so when, for example, Boris became Prime Minister, I'm not going to call him Boris, I'm going to call him Johnson. Part of the problem is we called him Boris from way too soon. When he became Prime Minister, he instantly sacked anyone who disagreed with him, specifically on Brexit, not just push them out of the cabinet, push them out of the party. So you've then lost that sense of a cabinet or a government or a party or a governing party being kind of a broad church, a coalition of opposing points of view, but fundamentally you're all set on the same course and it's your job to come to some kind of consensus or toe the line or follow it. But once you've said, no, anyone who disagrees with me, I don't even want to see you in the building or in the party, you're then... Well, first of all, you're then you're reducing the talent pool from which you can draw talent. So that became a problem. And then obviously, as you churn through some of those people, the talent pool got less and less. And then you ended up with Liz Truss, who didn't want anyone, really. You know, she didn't want the civil service. She didn't want the Office for Budget Responsibility. She didn't, you know, she just wanted herself and possibly Kwasi Kwarteng to be doing everything. So the talent pool, and I'm still clinging on to that word talent, but in this case, precariously, the talent pool is tiny. And it's about that. It's about... It's about government bills being issued not because they're workable, but because they express a wish of what we would like. So, for example, if people say, you know, Rwanda, you know, has its issues with democracy and freedom and so on, you know, we'll just pass a bill saying it doesn't. You know, that will stand up in the courts. They really genuinely think that will stand up in the courts. Or Boris Johnson saying, no, what we're going to do is we're going to have a Brexit deal that will allow, you know, a border down the Irish Sea and tell the DUP there'll be no paperwork. There'll be, you know, it's because in his head he thinks that would be perfect if we could do that. Mm. So they rush something through. And then it turns out, no, it doesn't work like that because in the real world, things are different from what's in your head.
Yes.
But what we're doing now is we're being drawn more and more to what's in certain politicians' heads and whether they agree. If they agree more or less with what's in our head, we think, well, that will be fine. So we don't question whether they're capable of actually showing any kind of leadership or what they're like in a crisis or what they will do with something that cannot be predicted or cannot be planned for, like a pandemic, for example.
I think one of the most horrifying true anecdotes that came out of the pandemic was Claire Watson, who was an aide in Number 10, said that when Boris Johnson got COVID, they had to make a, quote, puppy gate to keep him in the residence and not wandering into Number 10. And
he would
you know, like when you have a toddler and you have to make sure they don't fall down the stairs. They had one of them, essentially, and he would come and look over it like a sort of sad Labrador.
Jeez. Was there a Boris flap that he could...
But I just find that absolutely extraordinary. You want someone to lead the country, doesn't even have the self-control to sit quietly alone in a room.
And part of the problem was that he really didn't agree with the COVID pandemic. He didn't agree with it. He thought it was rude to spread. And if he was a pandemic, he wouldn't spread. And therefore, that's how he's going to operate, in that it's fine. It's absolutely fine. And it will go away. And that was part of the problem.
Yes, that didn't turn out to be true, did it, unfortunately?
Yeah, yeah.
I think the other thing I would probably pick up, and I'm interested in how you've reacted to this in your work, is that we entered a generation of politicians who self-ironized, who took the piss out of themselves, who got ahead of the mockery. I don't know, maybe this is my very wrong impression of the Victorian period, but I don't feel like Disraeli and Gladstone were kind of doing the equivalent of going on I'm a celeb, whatever that was in the Victorian period. Hard to call. But you know what I mean? There is a weird thing about politicians now. They don't want to be the straight man and let other people do the commentary.
Well, it's part of this, you know, the politics of personality. We vote for the personality rather, and whether they're what's in their head chimes with ours. They become their own kind of entertainers, don't they? They are all entertainers. Boris is an entertainer. Trump is a salesman, isn't he? He's a presenter. He's a salesman. You know, it's all about, hey, you know, I had the biggest crowd. I had, you know, people love me. You know, it's about numbers. It's about sales. It's about hits. And so they are kind of, which is why also it's difficult to parody them, because they are a parody. You know, they're conscious of what a parody of themselves would look like, and then they do it, almost to kind of like own it before anyone else can. So they're kind of, I call them self-basting satirists, in that they're kind of, they're, you know, so, and therefore, it's part of their charm, if there is, you know, is how they win, because people think, oh, politicians aren't like that. Politicians are very dry and a bit kind of contained, and, you know, they're probably not telling the truth, but they're so kind of outward, and they connect. And that's the thing. They, as entertainers, they connect. People talk about Boris Johnson. They talk about, I'm not sure Trump connects with any one particular person, but I know Johnson, and they said this of Bill Clinton, that, you know, when he came into a room, he would come up to you and you were made to feel like he was the only person you were interested in, until he then wandered away and talked to someone else. But for those, whatever, 10 seconds, you genuinely think, he thinks I'm incredible.
Yes, do you think we're going to go away? We're going to go on holiday together.
Yes.
Yeah, it'd be so fun, my new friend.
Sponsoring the show for this episode is Marquee TV. Marquee TV is a streaming service with a difference. It's bringing you the top tier of performing arts straight into your living room or onto your device. So think dance, theatre, music, anything you might find in the West End, Broadway, or maybe a cool little experimental space too, but saving you the cost of a few tickets as well. I've got happily a bit lost in their vast library of performances, exclusive interviews, and behind-the-scenes content. Choreographer Jonathan Watkins' interpretation of George Orwell's classic 1984 was pretty cool, and I love the dance piece Sutra, inspired by the skills of Buddhist Shaolin monks. And we've got a special treat for our listeners. Marquee TV offers 3 months of access for just 99 cents. That's right, 3 months for only 99 cents with the code SQUARED. Simply visit marquee.tv and use the promo code SQUARED to dive into the world of arts like never before. Bring the arts home with Marquee TV. The events calendar is filling up here at Intelligence Squared, and to create each one, we obviously rely on some brilliant guests and onstage talent. But behind the scenes, there's also a producer, a production team, and the budget in the mix too. You've got to keep an eye on all of that stuff in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. And you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because it's super easy to get started. NetSuite exists in the cloud, you see, no hardware needed. So you're cutting IT costs too. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared.
But they used to say that one of Barack Obama's early nicknames was Money, because he was so good at charming people into donating to his campaigns.
Right. Yes.
And he's a relatively emotionally restrained politician.
Yeah.
But he was, when he turned it on, there was just something there.
Yeah. I do remember meeting, it was before he was Prime Minister, the year before he was Prime Minister, Tony Blair, and we got a call saying that Tony Blair would like to be interviewed by Alan Partridge.
Now, I was going to bring this up.
Okay.
Because in a way,
yeah,
Tony Blair is your fault.
I'm quite happy to take most of his record.
Sure start,
Breakfast Clubs, all that. Not the invasion of Iraq. I don't think I planted that idea in his head. But, well, I'd be interested to see why you say that. Why?
Because you wrote a sketch for him, didn't you? Or a sketch that he would be in.
Yes. So the call came through saying it was the last Labour conference before the election. It was in Blackpool. Tony would like to be interviewed by Alan Partridge at a Labour youth event. Now,
I mean, that already is very Partridge to me.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Hey, kids.
All the words in that sentence are terrible, aren't they? And we thought, and Steve Curry and I thought, okay, well, we'll write a kind of interview, kind of Alan interviewing Tony, and it'll be about, we'll make jokes about the EU and the Euro and whatever. And it was quite, you know, it was about 10 minutes and quite dense. I mean, you had to be really quite adept at timing and everything. But he only saw it like 10 minutes before he went on. So I was already a bit concerned. And he'd come in and Alistair Campbell was there, and he'd go, right, so I say this, thing about the Euro, Alistair? Yeah. Okay, so, and then, say they're coming, yes, David Blunkett, yeah, Alistair? Yeah, okay. This whole bit, and he was a bit odd. He was very, what I'm doing now, just like, kind of, you know, he didn't connect. It was odd, very odd.
They used to call him Bambi. That was his first nickname before.
Bambi,
because he used to look like a little deer in the headlights.
Yeah, it was like that, kind of like, as if he's just seen a ghost, you know. And I thought, this is like going to be terrible. And he's just seeing it for the first time. And then he went out and he did it word perfectly and it was very funny, got the timing, you know, and I just thought, that's interesting and scary in that he's actually a very, very good actor, isn't he, really? So that was really, really interesting. But the odd thing was he would only come alive when it was his line. So, yeah.
We've all worked with actors like that.
So, exactly. So, I don't know. Let's do, so you be Alan Partridge. I'll be Tony Blair. You don't have to do the material, but he would go...
I'd ask you a question that would be something like, what's in your manifesto for young people? That's my Alan Partridge.
Well, Alan, it's a good that you asked me that funny thing about the Euro and David Blunkett.
Another question goes here.
Well, Alan, the thing is that, you know, it was just the weirdest.
Powering down.
I know, it was just the weird. I don't know whether Alistair Campbell, I had a switch. So it just went from human to Blair and just, it was just the weirdest thing. And I've never forgotten that. It's seared in my memory, that. Yeah.
Yeah, I remember he did a sketch that you and Catherine Tate, I think, have the honour of, dubious honour of having written sketches for Tony Blair, and he did a bothered sketch with her as well. And at the end,
yes,
he just went, does my face look bothered? And you were like, oh, that's very good.
Yeah.
And I thought it improves my truism about prime ministers. Tell me if you agree with this, which is that what people start off loving them for is what they end up hating them for. And Tony Blair looked very charming at the end. We went, oh, is it all just... It's all just an act.
It's that, yes. I mean, again, you know, the good things happened, I think, but that act was all part of the command and control that I think did so much damage to how government is run these days, that everything now runs out of Number 10. It all runs from the Prime Minister's office. It's controlled by the Treasury. You have the Prime Minister's... I mean, under Blair and under Brown, they had this set of people called enforcers, which is a bit like the Dementors in Harry Potter, who would fan out across the ministries and just tell them how much money they had, what they were allowed to do, what they had to say, and so on. So it was all about that control thing. And therefore, and I suppose, it started early under Thatcher, I suppose, but Blair and Campbell kind of perfected it. And then that gave you the model by which governments should then be run. So every prime minister coming in thought, well, I'll do it like that because that's how that we do it now. Which is fine if you're capable of doing that, of running the entire country yourself. But if you're not, which I'd say most of us aren't, you know, that's what the entire infrastructure of other ministries, the civil service and so on, local government, regional government, that's what that's there for. But unfortunately, we now reach the stage where it's become this much more presidential thing, where a new prime minister, even one who isn't elected. So when Johnson first came in, unelected by us, but elected by his party, then when Truss came in, unelected, but elected by a party, she just thought, I can rip everything up and start again because I'm now in complete charge.
Yeah.
And that is part of the problem. And it's added to that thing of everything being centralised and therefore how difficult it is to get government to function properly and efficiently across the country.
So you made Tony Blair cool to young people.
Yeah.
Let us move on to the second of your crimes, which is the fact that...
By the way, I've just suddenly remembered. Just the thing that kind of that complemented Tony Blair's kind of being switched on when needed is when we turned up at the venue, it was me and Steve Coogan and Peter Mandelson was there and he went, where's Alan Partridge? And... sort of had to be explained to him that he was a fictional...
I've been loving his documentaries.
Yes, he's a fictional character. And, I thought that was interesting. Anyway, you were saying, my other crime,
Your other crime is that for everybody of my generation who was interested in politics, they went into politics and specifically the civil service hoping it would be like the thick of it and indeed used to send text messages to me saying, it's just like the thick of it.
Yes, I'm sorry about that. I mean, it wasn't meant to be like that. It was, I mean, the thick of it was meant to be, you know, I was a great fan of Yes Minister. If you go back and watch Yes Minister, but it still stands up. It's the same old themes. It's, you know, Europe cuts the union, you know, this, am I important?
Environmental activism. His daughter becomes like a sort of badger activist.
Yes. There's one great one where he finds out he's not on an IRA death list. And he's just kind of, he's just concerned about what that says about him. And that was great. And that was inspired by stories that people told Anthony Jay and Jonathan Lynn about what went on in the Callaghan administration and then in the early Thatcher period, and they just fed it in. And you know, they're great, but it the model there, the setup there is slightly outmoded now because the setup was about the senior minister, the senior civil servant trying to stop the minister from doing stuff, you know, make sure nothing happens. But I thought at the time, and this was in the 200s, the noughties, that the model now was the civil service would be slightly marginalised because all the aides had been put in, the political appointments, the SPADs, special political advisors had been brought in, and they were running the
Which was all people I went to university with who were 25, and they were like, apparently I'm now in charge of the trains.
Exactly. That was my, you know, when I did research and I spoke to people and, you know, spoke to former ministers and civil servants and lobbyists and so on, that was a thing that completely shocked me, that a lot of the country is being run by 25-year-olds who are, you know, who don't yet know how to buy a house, but, you know, can... you know, draw up. I met when we were researching In the Loop, which involves the American government and the British government going into a war in a Middle Eastern country. I met a 27-year-old who'd got a degree in terrorism studies from Georgetown University in Washington, and consequently was sent to Iraq to help draw up the new constitution. And I mean, it's that.
We did a module on it.
Yeah.
It's going to be fine.
I know what I'm talking
Didn't
about.
Did an absolutely banging essay that week. Stand back, I've got this one.
I've got a constitution crisis. Can I have another week, please? And it was, you know, it's things like that. And just that perception that, you know, behind these buildings and these edifices that look grand and look like the people inside must know what they're doing. The answer is no. Oh, hello. Can you hear me?
They finally got you. Liz Truss.
Am I being spooked?
It's the deep state, Armando. They
Kremlin.
Work in mysterious ways.
I'm
going to take this opportunity to remind people we're about halfway through our section of chatting, and then there's a lot of time for questions. So if you have questions, start thinking of them. There are microphones upstairs. There'll be microphones roving downstairs. But I'm going to ask you one more, which is I recently met Dominic Cummings for the BBC series I'm doing for Radio 4.
Congratulations.
No, because you're not going to like what I'm going to say next, which is that I actually found him oddly charming.
Right.
But I then had to ask him very rude questions like, what was that all about then? That didn't go well, did it? I think it's very hard. Most of us are conflict-averse, confrontation-averse. And one thing I consistently run into is you meet people who you've written about in very rude terms, and they're obviously quite upset about it, and you feel bad if you're not a psychopath.
Yeah.
Unless, are you a psychopath?
Not that I know of, but then would a psychopath know? I don't know.
But do you consciously avoid meeting politicians?
Not consciously. I think some distance has to be kept. But it's not like I do impressions of current politics. It's not like I go out and I do... I'm trying to think of a current politician, but there's so...
If I brought Liz Truss on stage now, would you be like, sorry, Liz, I'm sorry I did all this
jokes? Oh, God, no.
Right, OK.
No. I think, what are you doing here? has it come to this? That you now make short guest appearances at other people's events. There's footage of her from about a month ago. She went over to a right-wing American convention. Was it CPAC or something?
It was a Conservative Political Action Conference,
right,
which has now become a totally shriveled version of what it was and is a sort of weird
Trumpist. And she did a big kind of her version of a rousing speech. And then at the end, when people were expected to go, it just went quiet. And she just sort of shuffled her things and walked off. As lots of people went, I don't know who that was.
I think it's the harshest thing that you can say about Rishi Sunak is that he lost a competition to Liz Truss. And it's like, that's who you're going to put in front of general election voters?
Yes.
Not even Liz Truss?
Yes. I'm just going to go back to, behind these closed doors.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. Because it's not that they're incompetent, and it's just that they're human beings. That's the thing. It could be us. And if you think how you get on a day-by-day basis, it's not pretty, is it? It's compromises. It's am I doing a good job? Somebody told me that when Kissinger was appointed by Nixon, he spent the first month going around going, am I doing a good job? Does he like me? Am I any good? And that's Kissinger.
That's a real story about how power changes you.
That's right. But you would also meet, for example, people were telling us that... Donald Rumsfeld, when he was recruiting people to run Iraq, he would ask, do you speak Arabic? And if you said yes, he'd say, well, we can't have you, because that shows you have pro-Arab tendencies. So it means that in the early days when America was running Iraq, it was full of people who didn't actually speak the language or understand the conventions, which sounds hilarious. And then, I don't know if you remember way back, there was about a period of the first 5 or 6 months, lots of, at checkpoints, American Marines telling cars to stop and a car coming forward with a family in it, so them firing on the car thinking they're clearly terrorists. And that's because it took them a while for someone to point out that in Iraq, that means come forward. And it's just that, those little tiny administrative peccadilloes, because someone's imposed their own personal. So it's not, you know, that's how bad things happen. People don't wake up in the morning going, what bad can I do? It's just they wake up in the morning thinking, I think I've basically got a decent grasp on this, so I don't need to be questioned about it, do I? I'll just get on with it. And then the consequences of things like that. We don't have proper checks on how people behave in power now.
Well, that's one of the questions that I put to Dominic Cummings about the kind of bad language being used in WhatsApp yes. groups. And I say, you know, if you found that your colleagues were talking about you in sometimes the really aggressive terms that were being used in those WhatsApp groups, would you feel empowered to speak up in meetings? And the kind of subsidiary question to this is, do you then select for people who are incredibly bullish, massive self-confidence? Uh-huh. Is that how Matt Hancock happened?
Yes. Well, I think, yes. I mean, Matt Hancock is an interesting example of someone who's so thick-skinned that he cannot see what he's like. The stories I'm told about how he operated in, and in fact, someone was told at the COVID inquiry, was he had this notion that he could handle it, you know, and therefore he kept using a cricketing, you know, they lob difficulties at me and I just bat them back. And it's that bit self-belief that then stops you from asking questions of yourself or telling yourself that what you also need is expert advice, guidance. There's a lack of curiosity. People stop asking questions if they think it might be about something they don't know anything about, you know. And my great, you know, one of the best prime ministers I think was Clement Attlee, who surrounded himself with rivals, but who were really good at their job, and he didn't mind the idea that there were people who were much more charismatic than him in the cabinet. As long as they got it done, that was fine by him.
That is one of the subplots of, I don't know if you've seen the play Nye that's currently on the National Theatre,
right, yes.
with Michael Sheen as Nye Bevan, and he's got Ernest Bevan in the cabinet. And he brings in Nye, who spent the entirety of the Second World War saying to Churchill, this is bad, you're bad at this, when no one wants to hear that at all. You know, just an absolutely obvious troublemaker. He's then brought in, Nye upsets all of the doctors who don't want a National Health Service, and Clement Attlee had the kind of stature to be able to manage big egos. This is the bit I think is maybe has been lost, is the idea that sometimes the best thing to do is to be Oppenheimer, right? It's to be the person who allows a load of big egos to work together.
Yeah.
You don't have to be the one that everybody's paying attention to. That's a different kind of power.
Yes. So Attlee saw himself as the manager, as it were, of the team, rather than the, you know, the person, the president of the team. And you know, it sort of happened a bit under Thatcher. Gradually, you know, over the years, the individuals started to speak very much under Blair. I mean, it's sinister. I'm not saying he masterminded this, but all the really charismatic or odd or individual cabinet ministers gradually disappeared.
So Robin Cook and Mo Mollem.
Who died. They all died.
No, I was going to say, that's a bit sinister.
But I'm not saying there's any. But he, you know, as the Blair cabinet over the years became more and more like Blair, more blander, filled with managerial figures rather than...
The arc of history is long, but it bends towards David Miliband, is what you're saying.
Yes. You know, it's that. It's just, that's the most individual person that was left.
Yeah.
Because of how he could eat a banana. In that photo.
But that makes sense, actually, which is, I think, the sort of tragedy of any political party. You know, Blair was such an effective arguer because he was elected in 1983, the same time as Jeremy Corbyn, at a time when the left was dominant. His was the unpopular set of arguments in the party. He had to make that case over and over again.
Yeah.
But then the generation that followed him could just say things that were like Blair, and that's how you got selected, and you got parachuted in.
Yes.
And there's a kind of process of renewal.
Exactly, and it becomes a kind of unconscious thing of surrounding yourself with yes people, and therefore, without you realizing it, so that you genuinely think that since they're all agreeing with you, everything you do must be correct, and therefore, you know, Iraq must be correct, because nobody's saying, don't do that.
Yeah.
Or if they do say that, they resign, you know. So,
and I think Brexit was, for a long time, if you wanted to get selected as a Tory candidate, you know, from electors, group of electors who were normally a kind of couple of dozen people over 65 in a kind of nice rural shire, what you did is you said, I'm massively in favour of Brexit. Mm-hmm. You did even whatever you regard, because you thought, well, it's never going to come up. I'll be fine. I'll just bask it. Yeah, Brexit. Yeah. Right idea. Well, yeah. Whatever it would have been called at the time.
Yeah.
You didn't turn up and go, Ken Clark, there's a man with the right ideas about Europe, because they would just go send you home again.
Yes.
It was a cost-free thing of way of saying, I'm on the right side.
And obviously, you know, as our leader, party leaders are elected now by members, members of a political party are almost by definition fanatical in that, you know, it's, you know, it they're obsessed by
well, they're not
their ideas,
normal people in the sense that normal people go out to work, don't think very much about politics, come home and watch.
So you're going to get the leader of that party elected by, you know, a specific type of person.
Let's say people like us.
Yeah.
Because really, we by being at an event talking about politics, we are, by definition, weird.
Weird. Geeks. All of you.
It's okay. Right.
Yeah.
We found our tribe. But you're right. The people in the country do not only consist of people who are hyper-engaged in politics.
Yeah. And then, you know, when they are in office, that's then why a lot of the country's going, who's this? And why are they so odd? You know, and the more they try and look like they're not odd, the more odd they look.
Thanks for listening to Intelligence Squared. This episode was produced by Connor Boyle and edited by Tom Hall. Don't forget, there's more of that conversation ready to dive into right now for Intelligence Squared members. You can get part 2 right away and also enjoy the exclusive members only part 3 as well. Just head to intelligencesquared.com/membership to sign up, or hit subscribe on Apple for just the audio. I've been Connor Boyle. Thanks for listening.